Hi, I'm Dirk Maggs, producer of The X-Files Cold Cases, and you're listening to The X-Cast.
Welcome back, everybody, to the X-Cast. The truth is in here. Tony Black's on his summer holiday, so I'm your host today, Carl Sweeney, and today we're covering The X-Files Cold Cases, which is the new audio drama available through Audible. And I'm delighted to be joined to discuss Cold Cases by Kimon Karamidis.
Hello, hello. Great to be here.
Yeah, it's great to talk to you. Now, in a moment or two, I'm going to give you the chance to explain to our listeners what your website, Eat the Corn, is all about and how that relates to The X-Files. Just before I do that, let me just give the listeners all the information they need to get in touch with us online. So if you want to email us, it's thexfcast@gmail.com. Please find us on Twitter at @thex_cast and join us on Facebook. Our Facebook group is called X-Files Basement, The X-Cast Podcast Fan Group. And just finally, if you do have time and if you do like our podcast, it'd be great if you could find us on iTunes and leave us a favourable review because that helps other listeners find us. Okay then, so as I mentioned just before, can you tell us about Eat the Corn and just explain to listeners what that's all about, please?
Sure. So Eat the Corn is a website focused on the X-Files and more generally on the works of Chris Carter. I try to follow his career in general, for beyond his just the X-Files, so we covered a bit the after and his other projects that didn't end up materializing. But well, it's a website that's been in existence for over 10 years now. Back then, it came after the big wave of internet activity in the X-Files, so after the X-Files wrapped up, and it came in that kind of that period when websites were disappearing and before I Want to Believe went to production. So that's when we had a complete picture of the mythology at that point, seasons 1 through 9. And I thought, well, there are not that many resources online to explain the entire X-Files mythology from A to Z. I mean, there were some discussion groups, there were disparate information here and there. There were GeoCities back then, which since then has gone offline. And so I compiled various things to explain the X-Files mythology. So that's how it started, really, to try to explain absolutely everything in the X-Files mythology. And that became the beginning of Eat the Corn, and it still is active today.
The aspect of your website that I like the most, I think, is the individual episode guides. For anyone who's ever been confused or unsure about any of the mythology episodes, I think it's a really helpful resource, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't pretend to have the absolute final word on absolutely everything. There are other theories out there, more or less crazy. But yeah. I do try to gather most of the information that most of the interpretation that can be claimed as truth out of the episodes. And so the main focus of the website is really the mythology episodes, the complete X-Files mythology primer, which is a kind of 20-page document that tries to summarize everything from the Big Bang to December 2012. And then from there on, I had gathered other information, so I just kind of put everything in the website, things like Mark Snow's music. I covered that quite a bit, try to find all the music cues throughout the 9 seasons that were interesting and that would be worth a commercial release. So since then, there have been commercial releases, which is absolutely great. But there's still a lot out there. And maybe one other thing I should mention is this interviews database that I have going on. I started collecting interviews of just Chris Carter in the beginning, then it became all the writers, and then it became anyone connected to 1013. So I have a 1013 interviews database online, which has more or less 500 interviews archived.
Yeah.
and have maybe a backlog of another 500 that I need to archive. So it's this is supposed to be a resource for all fans to find hard to find interviews before the recent wave of interviews from the 90s and things like this.
Yeah, I think your website's a really nice like treasure trove of resources and stuff. That's really, I think it's a really valuable addition to the X-Files online community. So I'll just put that on record.
Yeah, thanks. Well, it came out of a desire to keep things online, otherwise they might disappear. I mean, okay, you have archive.org, but it's nice to have something in the same place open there.
So what are your plans for the new batch of episodes then? You'll be reviewing them within a few days of them being broadcast, or you'll be writing about them, I suppose?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's a frenzy of activity once the most recent ones were aired. I try to follow them more or less live. I live in Europe, so there's a time difference there. And then since I tend to go quite to painstaking detail to find all the connections with past episodes and references to real life science or conspiracy theories, my articles tend to get a bit long, but they take the time that they take. So
yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing what you come up with anyway. I know you weren't too happy with My Struggle 2, so I hope the next episode pleases you a bit more, but we'll see.
There's always hope.
Okay, seeing as it's your first time on the X-Cast, Kimon, I'm going to ask you the five questions of X. And I know you've had forewarning of these to prepare an answer.
I did. That doesn't mean that the answers are final.
Yeah, oh no, we know they're very fluid, but we'll see what your answers are today. The first one is, when did you first discover the X-Files? So this answer should be pretty solid, I would hope.
Quite early on, I was able to track the date after the fact by looking at TV schedule. So I was in my early teens, or maybe even earlier. That was quite early, and I remember some friend had talked to me about this thing called the X-Files, which was on TV, and it had started gathering quite a bit of attention. We didn't get the episodes as quickly as in the US. There was maybe a couple of years difference, and so I taped the first episode on VHS. And I watched it kind of hidden, in hiding from a parent, because this is not the kind of thing that you would like a preteen to see. And so I watched it over a couple of days, and I fell immediately in love with the show. It's as if I already knew what the characters were all about, what the quest for truth was all about. And so that episode ended up being Little Green Men. So from the beginning, I had a contact with the mythology.
Ah, great stuff. All right, then. So the second question, this one is one that might change over time. What is your favorite episode and why?
Well, going into the mythology ones, I would like to say Anasazi. I mean, it's really has absolutely everything, revelations, mysteries, real life history and conspiracies connections, great music by Mosner. I mean, I can hardly find anything that would make me not to say it's my absolute best episode, apart from the fact that there are many others that are also pretty. But then, I also enjoy a lot watching all these Monster of the Week as well. As a shout out to episodes that might not be in everybody's favorite list, I can mention Firewalker, for example, that I enjoy visiting. I mean, I know it's a remake of Ice with Lava, but it's still nice. Darkness Falls as well. All these kind of fairly early ambient episodes, I'd say.
Yeah, even an episode like Firewalker, which most fans don't regard that highly, is still dripping with atmosphere and stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
That may be the only time Firewalker ever gets mentioned on that question.
So yeah.
that's a distinction, I think. All right, then. So Firewalker and Anasazi, both obviously in the second season. So what is your favourite season overall?
Well, I like the earlier seasons, obviously, and I tend to answer to this question either season two or season four, so I'm going to go three in the middle.
Ah, so what is it about that season that you think makes it deserve the accolade?
it's got solid stories. I mean, the earlier ones have very good scripts, the earlier seasons, but they are still struggling with the budget a little bit, and you can tell. Mm. By season three, they're really everything connects together: the visuals, the actors, the scripts, the Vancouver forests. You also have humor from Darren Morgan, which is concentrated in this season. Quite intelligent humor, and like some of the later seasons. So it's really got everything in there.
Yeah, I think I would say the third season as well. The only thing that I wish was in there was some involvement from Glenn Morgan and James Wong, because I love their episode so much. But I guess you can't have everything.
Yeah, well, that's why I answer two or four other times.
Next question then. Is who is your favourite character? Now, this can be Mulder or Scully, but it can also be any of the recurring characters, or even just a one-off mm-hmm. character.
Well, since it can be Mulder or Scully, you know, well, as I was younger, I tended to identify with Mulder more as a young mm-hmm. boy, and as a kind of in all these unexplained phenomena. But as I grew older and more into science, I'm more of into the scientific field and professionally, I tend to identify more with Scully. Mm. So really, Scully I like a lot. Otherwise, I would have loved it if they had developed these small little roles that each time that they get mentioned, I imagine what would have happened in another X-Files if they had fleshed them out more, like Melissa Scully or Senator Matheson. You know, there's a very early mention of who I guess turned out to be Senator Matheson in the pilot, even. Mulder says he has connections higher up. So it would have been great if they had developed these characters.
As regards Scully, I think she seems to be the character most people say these days. So I think a lot of people have the same experience as you, that Mulder was the character they were drawn to in the 1990s, and looking back at it now, Scully's become a lot more appealing over time, I guess.
Yeah, isn't it? I mean, it might be the disenchantment of adult life that makes us more oriented towards science. Or, well, okay, but the most recent revival has its bag of imperfections, but I like what they did with the development of the characters, because I get the impression that Mulder has developed more into what Frank Black more or less was in the beginning of Millennium, make a connection with another Chris Carter show. So this kind of person who was very much motivated when he was younger, a prodigy by all accounts, and who got burned by the contact with forces larger than him, and still tries to collect the pieces. So I think there's more to Mulder still to go on.
Yeah, one thing I thought was interesting was at the end of Founder's Mutation, when you see him sat at his table, you can see his domestic space is a lot more ordered, you know, than it used to be when he lived in the apartment. And I thought that was interesting, that he's finally, you know, he's finally tidied up a bit. And
that was one of the saddest scenes of the entire season.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, then. So the final question is, what is your favourite moment from the show? Now, this can be an entire scene or an exchange of dialogue or a look.
No Ho on the Roho.
Okay, so that's Little Green Men.
Yeah, Little Green Men. It was funny because since then I learned Spanish. I didn't know Spanish back when I saw that one. And since then I know what the guy says. I know what Jorge said. It was not part of the subtitles. So it was a nice discovery over the years, rewatching that episode and realizing, oh, this actually makes some sense. It's not gibberish. But Mulder's No Ho is just amazing. It's what a normal Spanish-speaking person would just say at that moment.
Yeah, well, I think you must be the first person who said that moment. So you've picked a couple of nice individual distinctive moments there for your answers. So great stuff. All right, Kimon, that's the five questions of X. But the reason we're here is to talk about cold cases. So let's talk about the X-Files cold cases. Okay, so Cold Cases was released on the 18th of July 2017. It's credited as being written by Joe Harris and Chris Carter, but we're going to talk a bit about Carter's involvement in a minute, hopefully. It's not quite as straightforward as that. It was adapted for audio and produced by Dirk Maggs. It was directed by William DeFries, and it stars David Duchovny, Gillian Anderson, as well as Mitch Pileggi, William B. Davis, Tom Braidwood, Dean Haglund, and Bruce Harwood. There are further cast members, but those are the guys who were from The X-Files. So, what is Cold Cases? I mean, this is one of those things that it's been marketed a lot recently, but I imagine there are still some fans who haven't heard about this. So, Cold Cases is an adaptation of Joe Harris's comics, and I was wondering maybe, Kimon, if you could just kind of contextualize the Joe Harris comics for us, and then sort of tell us how they relate to Cold Cases.
You do need some kind of context, yeah, because it's gotten quite a bit murky since the revival came about and everybody started calling it Season 10. Now there's Season 11 coming. So back when there was no live revival in 2013, IDW, the publishing house, got a hold of the X-Files license to produce X-Files comics, and these were called Season 10 when they came out from the beginning, because back then there was absolutely no plans, at least officially and publicly, yep, to produce a live revival. Carter was thinking of a third X-Files movie. So if there were to be a revival, it would be in the form of a movie. So Season 10 comics came about, written by Joe Harris mostly. We'll talk about Carter's involvement in a bit. But then, so they had this long-form storytelling in there. They mixed a lot of mythology, in full continuation with the show's mythology. That lasted about 2 years, and then IDW continued with Season 11 of the comics, which was supposed to last 2 years as well. But somewhere around that time, the live revival came about, and this was cut short. So then people were confused, what Season 10, where does it take place, when does it take place in the timeline, etc. It can get confusing.
Yeah, and I don't think it was helped by the fact that when this Cold Cases drama was announced, the press release talked about this as filling in some of the blanks about what happened after I Want to Believe. So
yeah,
initially it was confusing as to whether it was an adaptation of the comics that was going to be altered to fit continuity and so on. But I think the best way, I mean, I'll throw this over to you to see what you think in a moment, but possibly the best way for listeners to approach this is as an alternate timeline to the television series and the movies now that takes place after the events of I Want to Believe, but it doesn't reconcile with the new set of episodes.
Yeah.
There are some further audio dramas to come. I think it's unlikely that they're going to tie everything up into official continuity, but I think if canon's a big issue for you, you need to try and park that before you listen to Cold Cases, because it's probably not the best way to approach it. But what do you think?
Canon has become a big issue in recent years, hasn't it? I mean, since everything seems to be a franchise now, there seems to be a holy canon that defines limits between official and fan-made material. And The X-Files was not that big of a franchise. I'm thinking in comparison to, I don't know, Star Wars or even Doctor Who. So there was an absolute canon, which was a live TV series, and that's still it. But when these comics started being published, it was a bit in the middle. It was considered to be canon until, and so this until arrived. And we now have a point of divergence where you have the live revival and the upcoming Season 11, and the other one is what Cold Cases is.
Yeah, I think that explains it nicely. So this is the first installment of these adaptations. The second one is going to be called Stolen Lives, and that's due to be released in October, I believe, 2017. Yeah. Right, now if people are wondering how you get a hold of Cold Cases, so you need to sign up for Audible. You can get a free trial. I think that's what a lot of people are doing, is they're taking out the 1 month trial, and then you get a free credit to buy a book, and a lot of people are using that to buy Cold Cases. And then after the month's up, it's up to you whether you continue it, but then you have to start paying. So just so people know that. The other thing I'd say before we get into the detail is that it's worth checking your settings, because you can change the quality of downloads. And I've tried it on low quality sound and high quality sound, and I think there is an appreciable difference. So that's one thing that's worth checking before you download.
That's interesting. Okay.
Yeah, I found the sound. It's one of those things. Am I imagining it, or is it really a lot better? But it seemed much better on the high quality setting. So the next thing to point out is, yeah, we're going to go into some spoiler territory here. You know, if you're going to listen to Cold Cases, it's probably a good idea to listen to it before you listen to this podcast. One thing we're not going to do is we're going to try to not spoil anything that happens in the comics beyond the storylines that are covered here.
Promise.
Yeah, we're going to try our best. We're going to try not to spoil anything that happens in Joe Harris's comics, or the ones that haven't yet been adapted anyway.
Well, one thing we should point out is that this is an audio drama, maybe, and not a reading or anything.
Yeah, so that's a good point. So I don't listen to a lot of audiobooks, but I would think traditionally of an audiobook as somebody reading, you know, prose. But this is actually a kind of, like you say, it's a drama, it's sound effects, it's dialogue, it's all of those things. I mean, how would you best explain?
Yeah, because, you know, there were, in the 90s, there were these audiobooks read by Mitch Pileggi or Julian Anderson.
Yes, that's right.
This is not it. This is a full audio drama, as if you were watching a movie without the image, or listening to a recording of a theater piece, complete with audio effects and music sometimes. So it's a whole other thing.
Yeah, it's a whole other thing, like you say. It's got its own set then of conventions and expectations, and we're probably going to touch on some of those when we get into the discussion, so that'll be interesting.
I must say, I am not a big listener of audio drama, so if anyone from the production listens to us, I hope they will be kind with their understanding.
Yeah, that's the same for me as well. I don't listen to audio dramas typically, so I can only appraise it from the standpoint of an X-Files fan, yeah. I suppose. I can't judge it in comparison to other audio dramas, because I just don't have the knowledge. So let's take a closer look then at Cold Cases. All right, so what we normally do is we kick off by giving marks out of 10 and discussing normally an episode, in this case Cold Cases, in general terms. So if you had to rate this out of 10, what would you give it?
That's a tough one. I didn't think of that much, because there's the story aspect to it with which I was familiar from before, and this adaptation ended up being very faithful to the source material, much more than I expected it to actually. And then there's the whole audio drama bit. So I don't know. It's a great thing to have. It's a one of a kind thing from my approach. There are things that we will discuss about that I'm not too happy about either. But.
Oh, that's interesting. So yeah, you are right. It's hard to score this, because you almost have to separate out, you know, the different aspects of it. Yeah, you're coming from this from a standpoint of you were quite a big you enjoyed those Joe Harris comics a lot, didn't you? I think. Season 10 specifically.
Yeah, actually, I love them. Back when they were published, I was covering this quite in detail, and I enjoyed a lot what Joe Harris was doing with these. So it's interesting to see them adapted like this. It's both exciting and surprising as to how you had imagined it and how it turns out to be. Both in good ways and maybe not totally good ways, but it's very interesting.
Yeah, now I'm prepared a rating. I'm going to give this a 6 out of 10, but I agree with what you said, that it's a great thing that we've got this. I think it's really nice that this exists. I think there are some very, very good aspects of it, but there are some things which I wasn't as impressed by. So we'll get into that. What did you think generally about the quality of performances, and which cast members impressed you the most?
Well, I must say William B. Davis and Mitch Pileggi are absolutely killing it in this one. They're really good. And there's a lot of material for the cigarette smoking man in this one. No, they're really good. Obviously they're back into their roles, but they're also making it very exciting and gripping. Then there's the other two leads, Gillian Anderson and David Duchovny. And since Cold Cases came out, there was also a panel in San Diego Comic Con with Dirk Maggs, who adapted this and produced this, and David Duchovny. And well, he's not really hiding it, is he? He didn't give it much thought or spend much time on it, and I think you can hear it. It's definitely Mulder. It's his voice, obviously, but it could have benefited from a re-recording.
Yeah, you are right, I think. I do think that his performance was quite appealing anyway, I found. Despite the fact, he's very open about the fact that he liked doing this because the guys came around to his house and it was done very quickly, and you know, it's not something he spent a long time preparing for.
Yeah, well, it was done quickly. That's good for him. But you kind of get the impression that the source material was good, but they could have rehearsed a little bit more.
It's interesting. I agree totally about William B. Davis. I think he's the most effective performer here, and I'm actually just in the middle of reading his memoir, and there's some stuff in there about his experience recording Canadian radio dramas in the 1950s, and I just felt he seemed very, very comfortable with what was required of him.
So that's why, yeah. Well, it is a media form that was popular back then, right? So it does make sense.
Yeah, and even Duchovny talked about how, you know, you'd have to approach kind of jokes differently, and there are all these different requirements for acting in this art form. I think that experience may well have put William B. Davis in good stead. Mitch Pileggi's got some absolutely brilliant moments, think, and so I agree. I agree with singling out those two. Gillian Anderson, I felt, if anyone, there were some moments where she absolutely, you know, nailed it, and there were also some kind of uncomfortable moments with her.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, she did seem in character, and she was giving it all she had. But at times it looked as if, again, it would have benefited from another take, maybe.
I mean, one thing I noticed, it might just have been that as I listened to it, maybe I got more attuned to the style of it or something. But as it went on, I had fewer and fewer complaints about the acting. I think it was mainly, you know, when I was listening to the first couple of chapters. But I'm not sure, that may just be that I was thinking about other things. I'm not really certain.
I got that impression as well. So the fact that we both got a similar impression might mean that it's not just subjective. You know, it gets some getting accustomed to it, and for the actors as well. So maybe they just started with recording the first chapter, and then got more into it as it went on.
Yeah, I mean, that would make sense, wouldn't it? It would make sense for the actors to improve at the specific format as they got more experience under their belts. So that maybe.
And of course, we know that they recorded this separately. So the director and the editor of this does a very good job at pasting these things together, and I don't think it's coming from that. But the performance itself, you know, if you're just reacting cold from just with just a sheet of paper with a dialogue and a microphone in front of you, if you're not accustomed to that, it might be difficult. Yeah,
that's a good point to mention, that from what we can gather, most of the actors were recorded separately. So I'm sorry to spoil the illusion, but David and Gillian weren't together recording all these episodes. What did you think of the production values generally? So, the sound effects, the incidental music, all that kind of thing.
Well, there are quite a few layers in this, right? I didn't notice that much at first, because you need some good headphones. And a lot of it is very low-key or mixed at a lower level than the dialogue. So there are many very good audio special effects. There's even a bit of music, and it's quite subtle. But of course, I love Mark Snow, so it would have been really awesome if they had put some audio clips of Mark Snow in there, or even had obtained him directly for this, because a large part of the audio identity of the X-Files for me is really this mix of ambient sounds and the music itself. So it would have been a good opportunity to conclusion.
Yeah, what I would say is, when I was talking about the sound quality, this was the thing that I noticed the most on a second listen, because I listened to it twice to prepare for this podcast, and the second time I'd changed the audio settings. So I noticed a lot more of the kind of audio design the second time. Yeah, I think changing that audio setting to high quality is quite important, I think. Again, this is one of those things where I can't really appraise this with relation to other audio productions, but I felt that the work that was done here was very good, in all honesty. And I know that Dirt Mags has got a good reputation and everything. I haven't checked out any of his other work. It all seemed, you know, as I would have expected, it seemed very good.
Yeah, well, obviously there's a lot of attention to detail. Maybe not obviously, because you could have just expected this to be a quick and dirty thing, but it's not. They really tried to recreate the sound of the X-Files without Mark Snow's music, unfortunately. But yeah, well, the whole thing actually, more in general, the whole thing flowed quite quickly, I think. And I don't know if that's just me, because I like this ambient Mark Snow slow early seasons kind of vibe. But I think they could have slowed things down a little bit. Again, I don't listen to audiobooks either, so maybe people who do are more accustomed to this kind of tempo.
Yeah, and the other thing that's difficult is that obviously this is its own thing. It stands on its own. So people will be listening to this who have got no knowledge of the comics, and that's absolutely fine. So it's quite hard to know how somebody listening to this with no prior knowledge would respond to this as well, you know, how they'd respond to the pace.
Yeah.
All right, what about... So obviously we've got Mulder and Scully voiced by the original actors, and Skinner and the Smoking Man and the Lone Gunman, but there are some characters... who appear in this. So Deep Throat, Mr. X, Doggett and Reyes, for example, who are voiced by new actors. So what did you think about the, I'm going to call them the sound-alikes. So these are new actors voicing old characters. How did you think that worked?
Yeah, well, again, too bad that they didn't get the original ones, but it must not have been an easy task to do it. I thought Deep Throat worked fine. One I'm not too happy about is, spoiler, Krycek.
Yeah.
I mean, I get it why they did it, and I think you can hear more that they didn't record this or everybody together in the same room in this case. I don't know. Maybe if Krycek was directly interacting with Mitch Leggy or David Duchovny, we would have gotten something better out of it.
I think it works to varying extents, to be honest. And if anyone's wondering why all these characters are in it, yeah, there's a central concept, which means that old people involved with the syndicate are coming back. I won't spoil it too much, but they're coming back, but everything's not as it should be. But the other thing is that the lone gunmen in this story have faked their deaths, so they're still legitimately alive. So that's the reason why we're talking about all these characters, by the way. I think it is a kind of a problem when you've got a story which is about the uncanniness and the, you know, sort of impossibility of these characters being back as they were. Now, in the comics, it works because you've got the likeness on the page. But when you've got somebody different voicing them, I mean, if you'd imagine if they were telling this story on TV and they couldn't get the actor, they would probably rewrite the story, wouldn't they? So it just creates this kind of dissonance, doesn't it, when... It's supposed to be Krycek, for example, but unfortunately the actor doesn't sound like Krycek.
Yeah.
But I think it will bother people to different extents. I think some people will find it a big problem and other people will be able to kind of go with it.
Yeah. Well, I discovered these stories with the comics, really. So I'm still identifying with the comics more rather than the audio drama version, but. Okay, some people might like it. It's entirely possible. It's funny because I checked a little bit Dirk Mag's work other than this, and he has done some alien stories. And the funny thing with that is that apparently it was so successful that it got translated, meaning that a whole other set of cast recorded this in, I think it's German and French. So... It's funny to imagine what happens if this cold case gets so much success that they try to get all the dubbing actors involved as well.
interesting, yeah, because from what I understand, it's had quite a successful first couple of weeks on release. It's been doing quite well, from what I've heard. So, yeah, possibly. As we've said, we're both familiar with the comics. This is a fairly straight adaptation of the comics, isn't it? But there are some changes. There are some additional scenes. There's some restructuring of stuff. So what did you think about the alterations that was made to the sort of source material?
Well, first of all, it ties into the fact that this is definitely following the comics, and it's not attempting at all to tie into the live revival that most people would be familiar with. And I mean, they could have attempted to twist a few things to make more editing. It's really a very straightforward page by page adaptation of the comic book with some more exposition added in. Some of the comic book issues were starting with something that will happen later in the issue. The teaser was teasing the action within the issue, and then later on the action caught up with that, and here they didn't do that. They just went on chronologically, which makes sense. So it's more lighter touches than what I expected, which is interesting because when you think about what happens next, and we won't spoil that, but there's definitely more material in the comics to come, and it's really one single story from beginning to end. So I think they're really going ahead and adapting the whole thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you say, more exposition. I think that's probably a necessity of the kind of the format. You know, they've added this exposition because there's a need to keep a listener kind of apprised at all times, which I think on the page, there's not always the same need to do that. That does create some interesting issues later on. Maybe we'll talk about some of those. Yeah, and then there's more connective tissue, isn't there? So each chapter or each episode or whatever you want to call it, there are more references to previous ones than there would have been originally in the comic books.
Yeah, that was a good point in doing the adaptation. Certain fans complained that in the live revival we didn't get much of a transition between My Struggle and the rest. They just were back at the FBI as if nothing had happened. And here they do mention training for reinstatement. This spreads over several episodes. That's nice. There was some connective tissue, as you said, that was a good addition.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually, because that stuff's quite amusing. Yeah, completely different to the television series when they're back in the suits in the beginning of episode two, of course. All right, so we've talked about it in general terms. What we're not going to do is we're not going to do the scene-by-scene breakdown, because I'm not sure if I mentioned, but this is 4 hours long in total. We're not going to go through it in as much detail as we normally do for a TV episode, but we'll talk a bit about each episode or each chapter. So it's split into 5 chapters of varying lengths, and each chapter corresponds to a storyline from the comics, basically. Yeah, let's talk about the individual chapters. So, initially, Kimon, the first one's called Believers, and this chapter begins with a data breach at FBI headquarters which involves the X-Files, which prompts Walter Skinner, who's now a deputy director in this timeline, to contact Mulder and Scully, who are living under assumed names. So, what are your thoughts overall on the Believers?
Unbelievable. Because Skinner got a promotion.
Yeah, I mean, that's an indicator very early on, isn't it? Because if they wanted to try and pass this off as
that's a low-hanging fruit kind of continuity.
Yeah, it would have been the easiest thing in the world to change him back to assistant director, you know. But they've left it as it was, so he's the deputy director. And then later in the drama, we meet assistant director Morales. But Skinner got promotion. That's good for him.
Well, Believers. That's the 5 first issues of the comic. And the audio adaptation lasts for a bit over an hour, so that's quite quick, isn't it? I don't know. If you try to translate the action to episode equivalent, how long it would have been if this were a live adaptation, I think it would have been a bit longer. Yeah, I don't know. What did you think of it? I know I have a few points I want to mention about the mythology of it all.
I thought that it worked reasonably well. I felt that some of the exposition here was a bit too much. So there's a moment, for example, where Byers says about Scully, "Oh yeah, I forgot she had a baby." And I don't know if they struck the right balance between, obviously, you've got to try and catch up people who have forgotten or who haven't seen the episodes they're talking about. But I mean, it just strikes me as unlikely that buyers would forget something like that. So because this was the first storyline, that there's a fair bit of exposition about events from the past. So I felt it was a bit affected by stuff like that.
Pro Heike remembers. Yeah, well, yeah, this one in particular was not one of the better exposition bits. Yeah. Well, there's the whole thing about mentioning Scully's baby and Scully's baby once, Scully's baby twice. They never mentioned William's paternity, which should not be an issue at this stage. And it's funny because they mention William, the lone gunman, and I'm not quite sure whether they remember it at all, but right after that they mentioned the whole in vitro fertilization and Dr. Parenti in his labs and this kind of super obscure detail that that is much lesser importance than the existence of William. So yeah, it's a bit clumsy at times. It's funny because you could understand the necessity of having this exposition bit for listeners that might not remember the details, but on the other hand, it's very likely that those who will listen to this are hardcore X-Files fans, right?
Right, but the other thing is, I was listening to this part of this in the car with my partner, and she's not an X-Files fan, really, but she was listening to some of the exposition, and she just sort of said, why are they talking like that? People don't talk like that, you know? So I wonder if it does work for the people they're trying to, you know, it's kind of aimed at. I really do wonder. I don't know. But, I mean, I wouldn't want to nitpick it too much in that respect, because I think it is possible to get caught up in some of those minor details. I was wondering how somebody listening to all of this for the first time would be able to visualize, you know, these characters, the acolytes and so on. Because, obviously, I had the frame of reference of the comics. It goes past quite quickly. I wonder how easy it would be for people to follow who haven't read the comics.
It does go a bit quickly. But then it's really the whole material of the comics. And I don't think there's any new scene apart from that beginning bit with Skinner and the data breach. The whole action with the acolytes and the magnetite pipeline and all these kind of things, it's really as it is in the comic. And in the comic, you have time to reread a page or a bit of dialogue that seems quite obscure. In this one, you don't. And it's true. I wonder less than visualizing, which is an issue in of itself. I wonder to what extent people who haven't read the comics get the whole story, really, because it's quite dense and it's quite complex. And this is really what I like, actually, with the comics, me being a mythology nerd and all. It's got many references to past events. It's got connections across the whole storyline within the comics that are not obvious upon first reading. And even the whole plot, really, maybe not with believers, which is, it's simpler, but pilgrims, definitely, it's quite complex. I wonder to what extent this is simple for somebody who hasn't read the comics, and to what extent it would have been even better for a project like Cold Cases to adapt material that is better fit for audio.
Yeah, obviously we can't answer for other people, so maybe we'll just throw that out to the listeners. Maybe get in touch with us. If you came to Cold Cases with no prior knowledge, how easy did you find it to follow the storylines and so on? Because, I mean, I could imagine if you haven't seen Season 9 for a while, you know, all the references to Magnetite, it's kind of arcane. It may be tough to follow, but who knows? This is probably the point where we should talk a bit about Carter's involvement, because I think in the comic series, he got a co-writing credit on the Believers arc with Joe Harris. But as I understand it, his involvement was very limited, possibly just to the extent of kind of steering Joe Harris away from the original direction he was going in slightly. So what would you say about Carter's involvement? What's the best way to sort of frame that?
That's the credit he got in the comics was co-writing the Believers arc, and then he was kind of executive producer overall. And it makes sense for a tie-in product to have this label, right? It's a selling argument, let's say. And whereas here in Cold Cases, it's really co-written by Chris Carter and Joe Harris. So, I agree with you. I think the whole extent of Carter's involvement was just having a look at the synopsis of what Joe Harris was planning to do with Believers and tearing him away from a particular plot point that we might talk about later, or maybe not actually, because it goes beyond Cold Cases. And that's about it, really. So, yeah, I wish with Cold Cases, Joe Harris might have gotten a bit more credit. And I think if he didn't, it's because for contractual reasons, I think. I mean, Joe Harris did these comics for IDW. This Cold Cases project is Audible. And the only connective tissue between them is Fox.
It's interesting because I was seeing some fans online who were not happy about what they see as the inconsistencies. So, you know, Deputy Director Skinner, the lone gunman being alive and that kind of thing. And I was seeing Chris Carter being sort of blamed for all this. you know, I think there is real confusion out there about some of the continuity issues. I think it's a shame that people aren't fully appraised of what's going on.
You know, you have other universes, let's say, or like, I don't know, again, I'm not a specialist in UK shows, but Doctor Who comes to mind, which has a soft reboot incorporated in its storyline. And so you don't really have to worry that much about continuity things and canon. But the particular thing with the Cold Cases and these comics is that they really go into the core mythology. Again, it's an odd piece of work to choose to adapt because of this focus.
It is a curious decision. I mean, I would agree. You know, I know for a fact that some people enjoyed the season 10 comics more than others. So I think if you didn't like the comics, I don't think this is going to change your mind. But I think if you did enjoy the comics, then you're probably going to enjoy this. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah, but again, it would be interesting to find somebody who hasn't read the comics and comment about it.
All right, well, we won't spend too much time on Believers. We'll move on. But one thing I would say is that we did say it goes past quite quickly, but ultimately it is longer than My Struggle, you know. So it felt a bit more natural to me that by the end of Believers, they're reassigned to the X-Files. And, you know, whereas My Struggle on the TV was bang, 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 very frenetic. This, by the end of this story, it does feel a bit more earned that they're reassigned, I thought.
Yeah, one thing to mention in comparison with My Struggle is the fact that William is involved in this storyline, which it makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, if you have to find an something that would pull Mulder and Scully back into the paranormal and the X-Files, it would be William. So it was really puzzling to see My Struggle not really focusing on this.
Oh, and probably the other thing to mention then is that Mulder and Scully, whereas they'd sort of separated as My Struggle began, here they're still together, aren't they? So there definitely will be fans who appreciate that aspect of it. Okay, but Hosts is the next chapter, and it sees the agents look into missing persons reports connected to their earlier investigation involving the Fluke Man. So I thought this one was quite a good story for this format. It's one of the few, you know, relatively straightforward Monster of the Week storylines that actually appear in the comics. There aren't that many more to look forward to, I don't think. So it's interesting from that respect. Yeah, when I heard like the teaser sequence to this one,
that was great.
Yeah, I thought that was very, you know, atmospheric, and I really enjoyed that. Yeah, I think this is quite a successful one overall. What did you think?
I really enjoyed the audio in this one, the audio effects and the audio mix from the teaser onwards. I mean, all these squishy, jelly, kind of disgusting sounds. That's really, I guess, what audio drama is all about, right? You try to visualize something and you get all the help that audio can give you. So, it was a nice little story, quite short in terms of investigation, but that's really the adaptation of the comics. I believe that it could have been expanded a bit more to flesh it out in with more, you know, Mulder doing some research, maybe joined by Scully. This was really a page-by-page adaptation again of the comics, and the comics also are constrained by page number.
Yeah.
And here they were not, so, you know, it could have been nice to have seen a bit more of it.
That's a good point, because this is an adaptation of a two-issue story, whereas Believers was five, so this chapter clocks in at around about 40 minutes, I think, so it's quite a bit shorter. Yeah, they've changed the structure of the story as was laid out in the comics. So what it means is that you get quite a lengthy period towards the end of the story where one of the characters that they meet is kind of relaying the backstory of, like, the Frogman. Whereas in the comic, it's a bit more fragmented. It happens in a couple of different places. So I felt it lost a bit of momentum at that point, I'm afraid. But I really enjoyed the main Mulder kind of investigation.
They rely quite a bit on flashback. That's not the only case where they have this. It's funny to hear also foreign accents, not only in Host but also in Pilgrims. Here it's Russian. You know, I tried to catch the names of all the actors, the poor guys that didn't get a mention more than just a quick list read through at the end of this. And I did spot some, you know, vaguely Russian sounding names there, but I'm not sure whether they were involved in this particular sequence, because they're all speaking English with a very heavy, thick kind of caricature of an Eastern European accent. But okay, that's how it is.
And yeah, they don't, because we get the list of names at the end, but we don't get who played who.
Yeah.
So there's a bit of bit of detective work we need to do there, I think. Yeah, in this story, you get some references, you know, whereas in the comics, Doggett and Reyes go missing in Believers, and then they are not mentioned in Hosts. Here, we get a mention of them, and Scully talks about Frank Black, and Mulder talks about Gibson Praise, so possibly setting up some characters who might appear further on down the line. But yeah, it's just an indicator that there's more connective tissue between these storylines than we're used to in the comics, or indeed on the television.
And we do get to meet A.D. Morales, who has a vaguely Latino accent. Again, I'm not sure whether the actor is Latino or not, but they try to get a vaguely sounding Latino accent.
I suppose she's one of the more prevalent new characters that the comics comes up with, whereas a lot of the characters are returning. She's brand new, of course. But yeah, just in summation, I think Hosts is quite a good story. I was concerned that it might not have much impact because, you know, I think obviously the Fluke Man is so visually distinctive. But no, the audio production served it really well in that respect, I think. So I'd give a thumbs up to Hosts.
Yeah, I like Hosts. From the whole of Cold Cases, this was a good one. And they actually used the Fluke Man in promotional material. Audible did.
Oh yeah, there's a little trailer out there. That's worth checking out, actually.
Yeah. They did a whole recreation for the launching party or something in London, I think. With a full Fluke Man costume and autopsy. Yeah, I mean, The Host is a sequel to an episode that we all know, so they're also returning characters in Believers, so at this point, you either like what you're hearing or you're completely turned off because you think this is all fan service and it's really too much.
Yeah, I think that's a big dividing line, actually, amongst fans. And, yeah, that might even be kind of more significant as well to the next one, which is Being for the Benefit of Mr. X, in which Mulder receives a message that leads him to his old apartment, where he discovers evidence linked to the activities of his deceased informant, of course, the titular Mr. X. So Mr. X is played by somebody other than Stephen Williams. In the comic storyline, Mulder only encounters Mr. X at the very end of the story, and he only speaks a few words. Here, there's been a bit of a restructuring. So the early parts of the episode are Mulder and Scully tracking down the evidence. And then they encounter Mr. X, I don't know, roughly halfway through, I guess, wherein X gives him this backstory on an event that Deep Throat once alluded to, which is kind of a test in the school, isn't it, of the purity virus and so on. So the restructuring means that X is very, very chatty in this one. Whereas in the series, he was very, very terse. And he didn't say much more than he had to. In this one, he talks at quite a length.
Yeah.
So I thought that it was interesting that they didn't have Stephen Williams, but yet they expanded X's role and they didn't try and sort of hide that fact.
If they chose to tell that story, they had to go through all this. Yeah, you have more flashbacks again, events taking place way in the past, 1988 or 89 or something. You have a whole narration which doesn't have the same intensity of the Mr. X that we're used to. It's nice if you're a mythology fan, but then in terms of audio, not the same as Mr. X.
Yeah, I felt this was probably the weakest chapter, actually. I didn't think it was a natural fit for an audio adaptation.
I think if they wanted to make more of an adaptation, this one is the one that they could have either skipped or reimagined from scratch. Because, I mean, we're going to cover the rest right now, but there's a lot of mythology in here. I think they could have imagined some way to tell this story without going through it step by step.
Yeah, because without spoiling too much, Mr. X, I don't think he plays much part later on, does he? So if they had wanted to streamline the stories or to eliminate a story or two, they could have done that.
Yeah, but it was nice to be back in Apartment 42.
Yeah, like I say, I did quite enjoy that procedural aspect to the sort of first half of this story, you know. Going back in the apartment, there's a new couple that lives there, finding the X on the window, and then testing the blood and so on. Yeah. I quite like that. So in this one, we also get Deep Throat for a scene or two. You said you were quite okay with a Deep Throat sound alike, but I felt that this guy didn't sound much like Jerry Hardin at all, actually. I felt the guy playing X at least was fairly close to Stephen Williams, but I mean, Deep Throat's not as central to this story.
Yeah, but he gets way less dialogue as well than Mr. X, yeah. What we do get in terms of story, we do get this whole connection to these past episodes. With what's going on here is a purity control test that was mentioned in the series. I guess Deep Throat mentioned this in way back in season one and the LMI flask. So Harris is kind of filling in holes where conspiracy stories might have happened. So that was a nice touch. And we do get an introduction of this whole business with the blood vials, which becomes very important.
Yeah, you're right. Harris is very attentive to sort of fleshing out bits, you know, references and offhand comments from the original series that were never explored in depth. Yeah, I know a lot of fans would appreciate that kind of thing.
He also loves American history and 20th century history, so there's a lot of connections to, you know, the Watergate scandal at one point. At some point, Mr. X is ready to spill the beans at the Washington Post. So there's another connection there. So it's, yeah. He's having fun with these conspiracy / real world connections.
That's a staple of his run on the comics all the way through to the, you know, the most recent issues as well, isn't it, I think?
Yeah, definitely. So it's a... as a comment to the whole Cold Cases project, I mean, you got Gillian Anderson and David Duchovny attempting to reprise their roles, and you could have made the most out of it by giving them even more scenes to play with, more investigation, more banter, more teasing. No, it would have been nice to have even more scenes than what we got and what Max added.
That's a good point, I think, because Hosts is probably the closest to a traditional Monster of the Week investigation. But even in that one, they're separated for, you know, the bulk of it. So I was really looking forward to the story Chitter, because I think that's a good comic. I think it's going to make a good audio drama. But that's the one that should come next. But it's been either eliminated or more likely it's being repositioned into Stolen Lives, but we're not entirely sure yet, are we?
Yeah, I think it makes sense that it's repositioned in terms of the length of this thing, but we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. In the comics, the next story would have been Chitter, but in the audio drama, Cold Cases, it's More Musings of a Cigarette-Smoking Man, which involves Cancer Man reflecting on his past as he surveys documents found in the Syndicate office. All right, before we get into this one too deeply, I just want to ask you, what did you think of the fact that the Smoking Man was continually referred to as Spender in these dramas?
Oh, yes. There's also a lot of Walter for Skinner, which it did happen a couple of times in the series.
Yeah, the Skinner thing didn't bother me so much, but the Spender thing did. Now, I think the rationale is probably that they wanted to give him a name. You know, it's audio. They need to keep referring to him as the same thing, I guess.
Yeah, there are other odd things, like the cigarette smoking man referring to his peers as well manicured man, which is something that we've never seen written or heard in the entire series. Not even written, or it's something that exists only in the script.
Yeah, because in the comic, it's kind of an Easter egg, isn't it? Because there's some files or something, and it says WMM. On the files, and FE for First Elder and everything. But in this one, he says, you know...
Yeah, they took it quite literally.
Yeah. And the villainous character, who we don't know the identity of at this stage, is referred to as Prime Elder, whereas in the comics, I don't think he was called that at any stage either.
I don't think it was called by name, actually. Who was called by name was Deepthroat, and that was Roland. And that was an interesting callback to using the cigarette-smoking man. But again, we're not sure whether that's his real name or anything.
But this issue about Smoking Man being called Spender, etc., etc., it does hit on one of the problems I had, which is that there were some exchanges, and particularly in this episode, I think, that weren't really in the spirit of the original series. So when you hear a line like, "Welcome to the Syndicate, this is the first Elder," that's not the way these guys would ever talk on the TV, you know. The X-Files was much more about vague allusions and not laying everything on the line like that. So I can understand the rationale. I understand why it was done.
Exactly.
It's one of those things where it didn't quite sit well with me, you know.
Yeah, I can understand the position these people were in when they were adapting the comics, how to make a person understand what's going on. I can understand why, but it's true that it's quite jarring. And Spender, no. Cancer man at best, or
yeah, Smokey, or
black lunged son of a bitch.
Yeah, Spender is actually the final word of the drama at the end of Pilgrim. Spender is the very final line that's spoken. It kind of encapsulated some of the problems I had with cold cases in general. But what I would say about this one is that I was dubious about how well this adaptation would work in regards to more musings of a cigarette smoking man. But because William B. Davis is so adept at this type of acting, I think, I felt that his performance carried this very well. And I just found it a pleasure to listen to him, even though he had some tricky dialogue to deliver and so on. I felt it was a pleasure just to listen to him.
Well, this more musings of the cigarette smoking man, it's the weirdest thing. I mean, okay, the Joe Harris did it in comics form, and for me, it was absolutely one of the best surprises of the comics because of all the Easter eggs and all the, you can feel the passion of Joe Harris in this case, who wrote a story, connected the dots between scenes that are referenced in the TV series, but also made it look as if we're not sure whether what we're seeing is real or not. Same as with the real episode, Musings of a Cigarette Smoking Man. It's really well crafted, and in the comics version, the visuals were amazing as well, because they... Jumping from period to period, from 50s to the 60s to the 70s, etc., you had a different drawing style. This went hand in hand with the fact that this reconstructed CSM was delirious, or he was not sure whether he was remembering or reconstructing his memories, or just taking cues from the documents he was reading and constructing a life from scratch. All these identity crisis kind of issues, which made a really interesting piece of work. It was an absolute joy to hear William B. Davis read all this. I think this was a high point for me. But again, this is purely from a fan of mythology that geeks out on these details. But this is definitely not a mainstream concern for an audiobook featuring David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson. So I'm really happy we got this, but...
Yeah, it's just odd. Mulder and Scully are given a scene at the beginning of this episode, just to kind of ensure that they're involved, I guess. It kind of foreshadows the next chapter. But as you say, if you're someone who's just here for the Mulder-Scully relationship, you're probably going to be left a bit bemused by more musings of a cigarette-smoking man.
Yeah.
I think there's one change from the comics which I noticed, which I thought kind of summed up some of the differences between the source material. So there's a scene early on at a base where you're hearing a Kennedy speech through the loudspeaker. And in the comic, the date that's given is actually not the date Kennedy delivered the speech. It's actually the following year. Now, in the audio drama, they've changed the date to make it accurate, to make it on the same date that Kennedy delivered the speech. But I would guess that Joe Harris probably put that discrepancy in intentionally, because it plays into the idea of memory being unreliable and did this actually occur? Whereas what the adaptation has done is literalize to an extent, what was vague and possibly unreliable in the comics.
That's nice. Well, what I liked about this particular bit is that they dug up the original Kennedy speech, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what it sounded like, at least.
It did sound like that, yeah, yeah. Okay, so like I say, I was pleasantly surprised, actually, because I thought this was a very tricky one to adapt. And I think, in large part, the credit goes to William B. Davis, so hats off to him.
Okay, so it's a treat to the mythology fan, but what I particularly liked about this one, and this is about the plot. In this one, we understand how all these people returned from the dead, all these syndicate members were created, or at least it's insinuated, and you really have to be paying attention to the details to get what's going on. With all this business of the blood vials and the taking shots and making archives of your blood at different points of your life.
Yeah.
So for me, this is where Joe Harris managed to explain that, okay, I'm doing something that you might call fan service, but I'm really presenting you an in-universe explanation for why I'm doing this. And this has a purpose, and this has a story that I want to play out using these characters. So I really like that.
Finally, then, we had Pilgrims, in which Mulder and Scully investigate an apparent terror attack on American contractors in Saudi Arabia. And this one heavily involves Alex Krycek, and he's not played by Nicholas Lee. At one point, Mitch Pileggi delivers the line, "Krycek, you piece of shit," and it was one of the most glorious line readings I'd ever heard. So, I mean, the fact that it's not Nicholas Lee responding is just a shame. Obviously, we don't know if he was approached and couldn't do it, or didn't want to do it, or the budget didn't stretch any further, or, you know, we have no idea. But nonetheless, it was a shame that Krycek wasn't voiced by Nicholas Lee.
Yeah, maybe they will do a re-recording later on with Nicholas Lee. Imagine that.
But what did you think of Pilgrims overall, then? Because like you said before, it is quite a dense storyline. How well did it adapt to this format?
This one was trickier. I mean, you have to embrace the pulp of it all with, you know, people being possessed and sounding differently. You know, being possessed by the black oil or shape-shifting throughout the series. It's quite ridiculous. but you have to signify it somehow, right? It went fine until I think the later bits where it's all going again a bit quickly with the Skyland Mountain and the whole climax of the story with people being burnt alive. I mean, there are several examples in throughout Cold Cases where you have a character just describing what's going on.
Yes.
Oh my God, I'm being shot in the arm. Why did you do this to me?
Yeah.
Or with the burning bodies all around. What are we going to do? We have to find an escape. This is where it would have benefited from tighter acting on behalf of our needs.
I mean, it does. I think what it does do, obviously they're in Saudi Arabia, Mulder and Scully, in the early part of the action. So this kind of has the feel to an extent of something like Piper Maru, Apocrypha, or Tunguska Terma, with kind of the globe-trotting mythology storyline that we had there. One thing that is, I think we just mentioned this change from the comics, because it's quite an interesting one, which is that in the comics there's the implication that the alien that inhabited Mulder sort of has sex with Scully, basically. And obviously Scully wouldn't have consented to that if she'd known what was going on. But here they've removed that. I wouldn't say downplayed it. They've actually removed that aspect of things from this storyline. I felt it was probably a wise move.
Yeah, Mulder just arrives home and then it takes on from there. Yeah, that was a very wise choice, I think. Throughout the comics, I mean, if there's something that you can say as a negative about the comics is the lack of Mulder and Scully interactions, maybe. You know, you have them discussing a bit about the plots, but not that many heart-to-heart discussions or not necessarily shipper territory. I mean, that as well, but also you don't have that many wider philosophical discussions. You know, what does this case mean about human nature or whatever? This could have been an opportunity to add that. Still, I'm surprised that they kept that faithfully to the comic.
Do you think Pilgrims was an effective, you know, end point? Do you think it works well in sequence where it is? This is obviously the final episode now before the end, and then Stolen Lives will pick up at some point in October. How well do you think Pilgrims works as the finale?
Well, again, it's interesting to conceptualize this in the wider adaptation of these comics, knowing what's coming in the comics, because the comics had to be adapted to real life happenings, meaning the revival.
Yeah.
So a few of the storylines were cut short or just left hanging. So it's all the more odd that they didn't try to rewrite or adapt further cold cases to shape it up into something that will have a beginning, middle, and end. I mean, back when Pilgrims first came out, there was a lot of expectations for what would come later. A lot of it pays off. Some of it doesn't, and all the elements that don't are already improved. So it's an interesting situation.
In terms of stuff that doesn't sort of pay off, I don't think we see Krycek again, do we?
No.
He's somebody we would have had the comics run to their full length, you know, as planned. We probably would have expected to see him again, but it's not spoiling too much, I don't think, to say that Alex Krycek doesn't feature again after the Pilgrim storyline.
Yeah. What does feature, though, is this Neo Syndicate. Led by this voice that in the comics is the glasses wearing man, which obviously the audio drama listeners wouldn't know about.
It's going to be interesting to see how people react to the eventual reveal of that character. Yeah, because I guess it was possible to piece together from the comics what was going on there, but it's probably harder here.
Yeah, right. So there is a story being told. There is something coming up that has close ties to the mythology, and hopefully with Stolen Lives there will be more Monsters of the Week as well.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the Chitta storyline. I think that's that should make a very good audio drama, I think. I think that should be one that's very eerie and effective, so I'm looking forward to that. Which of the storylines would you just flag up as being, you know, possibly worth people listening out for in Stolen Lives? Which ones are you specifically looking forward to?
Well, the final story, really, that's called Elders, and fans of the series should know what to expect with such a title. But I found it interesting that there's a lot of part of the action that takes place in Cuba. So after Saudi Arabia, Cuba. So when these came out, it was a time of détente between the U.S. and Cuba. Now it's again in a phase of tension with the new U.S. administration. So I like these little touches of Joe Harris commenting on real-world politics. We'll see how it bears out in an audio form.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. So like I said at the start, I gave this a 6 out of 10. I do think your perception of the source material will have an impact on what you think of Cold Cases. If you haven't read the comics, I'm not sure how you'll react, so I'll be interested to hear how people get on with it.
Yeah. Well, it's really a tie-in of a tie-in, isn't it? I mean, they first developed the comics as a tie-in to the X-Files, and now it's the tie-in to the comics.
Yeah, ultimately, I'm pleased that these comics have had a curious kind of afterlife in the form of this audio drama. Ultimately, I think it's a good thing.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing to have.
Definitely. All right, well, thanks, Kimon. I mean, before you go, is there anywhere people, you know, do you want people to be able to find you on social media?
Well, yeah. First of all, again, eatthecorn.com. That's where the action is. There's a Facebook page that you can like, the X-Files Eat the Corn, that has more news than the website itself.
All right, well, thanks very much, Kimon. It's been great to talk to you. And, yeah, it sounds like we're both cautiously optimistic about Stolen Lives, which is coming in a few months' time.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me.
Well, that's it for now, listeners, but until next time, always remember, trust no one.
The X-Cast is produced and presented by Tony Black, part of the Black Hole Media podcast network. Title music is courtesy of Will A, who you can find on Twitter @IAmWillAYE.